nice to have you back, Matt, on this podcast.
Hey, well, thanks for having me, Nima. It's a real pleasure, and I appreciate being a regular of yours. It means a lot to me, and same with the folks who are watching as well and listening. It means a lot, so thank you.
Let's get started, Matt, with what's going on in the Middle East. It seems that Netanyahu, again, they're talking about they want to attack Hezbollah. Mm. Do we understand, before coming to the United States, he was talking about this attack. And right after that, we had the assassination of leaders. Right now, he wants to attack again. What's going on in their mind, in your opinion?
I think Hezbollah and Iran did not take the bait, right? They didn't take the bait of those assassinations and launch these massive attacks that would have justified not just Israeli mass retaliation, but also, you know, because you correctly identified it, that linkage of Netanyahu coming to the United States and getting the United States Congress to kneel and kiss his ring. You know, that a mass Iranian Hezbollah attack over the summer would have given Israel not just, again, to Netanyahu, not just what it wanted, but also too would have given what many Americans want, this war with Iran. I think what you're seeing now is because Iran and Hezbollah did not take the bait. And we've talked about this, about how it seems likely that the axis of resistance strategy, the correct strategy for them to pursue, is one of a long game. Just continue to exhaust Israel, continue to exhaust the Americans for that point as well. I mean, we can't even keep our aircraft carriers on station, right? We don't have the ships to send over there. We're exhausted in a multitude of different ways. But then also, too, let Israel chew itself up internally, right? Exhaust the IDF, stress the country out economically. I mean, the toll on the Israeli economy at all levels, from Main Street to, you know, their brokerages and their investment funds, has been really brutal. I mean, they're just bleeding out. And then, of course, we all know, I mean, no explanation needed about the political circumstances in Israel right now. So play it out, right? This just, and so I think what the Israelis are, you know, Netanyahu, but the Israelis are looking at, okay, we've got to strike quick. I mean, if Matt Ho is saying this type of thing, if like people, you know, outside are seeing how this is developing and how this spells doom for Israel, how this long approach is just going to get Israel again to exhaust itself and chew itself up. The Israelis know this, and Israelis have been warning about this, right? I mean, you have multiple senior Israeli officials, not just retired, but also active, like the current head of Shin Bet, the Israelis' version of MI5 or FBI, you know, warning just about this, about we could go into civil war, you know, let alone all the other indicators there. The IDF saying, we're exhausted. Please stop this. Please get us a ceasefire. Please do not commit us to war with Hezbollah. We're exhausted. We need to rest. We need to regroup. We need to refit. You know, I mean, all those things. So they know this. So maybe the idea is we need to get this now. And we can't, just as Hezbollah and Iran did not fall into our trap, we cannot fall into their trap of a long-term struggle here. And so I think that's what really is animating Israel right now, is the idea of we've got to end this thing quickly. We've got to find a way with, preferably with the U.S., to launch these types of strikes on Hezbollah, on Iran, and make it so that their long-term plan falls apart, that they can't continue with that. I mean, I don't think it's possible for them to do, you know, but I think that's the mindset. And of course, then you have to also calculate in that Netanyahu needs these wars to continue for his own political survival. But even that, you know, with the way the polls are there, you know, we talked about this last week, because last week there were a few hundred thousand Israelis out on the streets protesting against Netanyahu to get their people back, their hostages back, you know, demanding a ceasefire for that reason, not because they want to end the genocide, not because they want a two-state solution. They don't want to see a Palestinian state, but they do want their people back. You know, this weekend, I think yesterday, their estimates were 750,000 were out on the streets. But at the same point, too, the polling shows that Netanyahu is still, if the elections were held now, he would survive. He would be the one who'd be able to keep a coalition, because he has this base of support that's unshakable. And so you have 750,000 Israelis on the street waving Israeli flags. And who are they being watched by? 750,000 Israeli settlers armed who view those people as traitors, not just to their country, but to their God. And so you can see how this is real dangerous. So, you know, the idea for Netanyahu has to understand that dynamic. And so he has to find a solution that puts aside that pathway towards civil war, essentially, right? Which also has other lesser paths of just general political chaos and instability. And maybe the best way to do that is to launch a war that unites everyone beneath the war, right? I mean, so I think that's essentially where we're at right now.
Yeah, we've learned that the U.S. commander of CENTCOM is in Israel right now. Do you think they're telling them that they cannot stay there forever just for the sake of this, or something else going on?
If they're not telling them that, I don't know what they're telling them. I mean, General Carrillo might be there just, you know, burnishing in his bona fides in terms of being a staunch supporter of Israel and telling them what they want to hear. But, you know, which is a likely shot because that's the trajectory of American generals, right? You know, so many American generals are truly political generals in the sense that their own personal gain is what they're looking for. But I would say that, what he should be saying is that, look, we can barely keep our ships at sea. We can barely man our ships. The U.S. United States Navy, the only way it's making its recruiting quota is by bringing in people who fail to meet their academic, intellectual, or academic intelligence and physical standards. I mean, these are standards that were developed over a long period of time where the Navy said, all the services said, this is the bare minimum for someone to come into the military and perform at a level that's adequate to our needs. Trust me, I was in the Marine Corps for 10 years. I could tell you that bare minimum is a bare minimum. You know, and so the Navy has such a recruiting problem that it is going below those minimums now to bring people on. If you want to enlist in the Navy, you can be 41 years old, enlist in the U.S. Navy if you want. You don't need a high school diploma. I mean, like, so that's the reality. Not just the not having enough ships, not having enough munitions, not having the ships that supply the munitions and the fuel to the ships that do the fighting. I mean, all those things, but they just can't even get enough men and women into the service to man these ships if that wasn't a problem. I mean, and that's just the Navy, right? I mean, and there are other problems across the other services. So this idea that we can keep two aircraft carriers on station there with their battle groups, firing a lot of munitions, constantly having to be rearmed, and our logistics capability is stretched to the max. You know, a lot was made about the fact that a couple of weeks ago, we were made aware that the 500th U.S. Transport plane had landed in Israel, either a C-17 or a 747, so really big planes, right? Of that, so there has been well more than 500 deliveries by air of weapons and vehicles and equipment for the IDF. Also, to well more than 100 ships, which comes out to roughly every 12 hours, the United States is providing a weapons shipment to Israel. But that is stretching the U.S. military in terms of its logistics capabilities. And so you have an exhaustion within the U.S. military that how do they keep it going? And the idea that the United States, this is the prevailing theory, may not be in doctrine yet, but in practice it certainly is, that we are going to fight three wars at one time. If anyone out there wants to write in the comments how that would be possible, knowing everything we know about the current state of the U.S. military and how stretched thin it is, what our defense industrial base is like, how much we can actually produce, the recruiting problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyone wants to tell me how we fight three wars at one time in a serious note, please do. I'd be delighted to read that because I just don't know how that would be possible, right? But this is the reality that the U.S. military is. So going and hopefully, that's what the U.S. military is telling Israel is we just can't do this. You know, I mean, this gets into larger things, you know, larger an understanding, appreciation for the American empire. We have 11 aircraft carriers. You know, typically the way that is supposed to work is that roughly three or four are at sea at one time, roughly three or four are back at their base, getting maintenance, their crews are on leave, you know, people are getting trained, and roughly three or four are getting ready to deploy themselves. So they're going through training and doing workups and everything. And then on top of that, you usually have one or two that are in the yards, as they say, that are in the maintenance, in the dry docks, right? Getting major overhauls done. And so you have this rotation, right? You could three, three, three. You could see how that works. Three on station, three working up, three that just got back. We can't even maintain that anymore. I mean, that's the reality of the American Navy. It can't even keep up with that. You know, so, you know, we can have all these $15 billion aircraft carriers with their 60 attack jets on them. But if you can't keep them at sea, and then let alone the same issues with resupply, because our logistics fleet, our supply fleet is just, there's another thing that came out that the United States Navy is decommissioning 17 of its logistics ships because it can't man them. And these are not uniformed sailors who crew these ships. These are civilian mariners. They can't get civilians to do that work, right? I mean, so, okay, you can't even refuel and rearm the ships at sea. You know, another thing that came out earlier this year was a study that found that the United States, if it went to war with China, it only has about 10% of the oilers it needs to keep its fleet fueled for a major war like that. I mean, so this is all just smoke and mirrors. I mean, this is all just one big dog and pony show. We're running around with our chest puffed out, hoping nobody calls our bluff. And I mean, essentially, that may be what the U.S. is telling the Israelis right now. You can't call our bluff. We're not good for it. Or it could be, look, we've got these two carriers here and their battle groups on station. We've got at least one sub. You know, that's a lot of firepower. If you're going to do anything, do it now, because we're exhausted and our ships need to go home and we're not sure what's going to replace them. So that could be the other thing, Nima, is that they're telling them, hey, look, here's our schedule. We're on the clock. You know, if you're going to do something, do it sooner rather than later, because we're not sure if we're going to be able to support you later.
The other thing, Matt, that Netanyahu was talking about, the northern part of Israel, he was talking about sending these people to their homes. But we know that the problem in the northern part of Israel is because of these tensions between Israel and Hezbollah. Yeah. And as long as they're doing what they're doing in Gaza, how they can expect to have some sort of, how do you say, sending these people just living there? And it's impossible. In your opinion, yeah, what's going on in his mind?
It's great propaganda. It's great PR. It keeps the hysteria moving forward. The inertia of October 7th is just, you know, keeps, you know, for that constituency, you know, as well as for their American benefactors as well, you know, and the idea of that it allows those in the American Congress, those in the American media, both presidential candidates, and then the continuing declining minority of Americans who support Israel to say, look, this is why we have to do it. Look, these people can't even go back to their homes. And of course, the idea of sending them back to their homes is ridiculous. I mean, would you bring your family back to have a Katyusha rocket fall in your house? Of course you wouldn't. You know what I mean? Like, anyone who would shouldn't, you know, should be taken away from his family. Like, that's, you know, you should not. I mean, but that's, so the crisis in the north and these 100 and 150,000 Israelis who are living in hotels in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and Haifa and other places at the expense of the government. I mean, this is a huge economic cost. One of many things that are causing this economic hemorrhage in Israel. It is politically useful. And if these people suffer, if their businesses are destroyed because of it, if their kids, you know, grow up in this internally displaced refugee lifestyle, then so be it. Because for people like Netanyahu, people like his governing coalition, these are pawns, these are props that serve a very good purpose for them. So I think that's what they're looking at. You know, I mean, this idea of this continual tension. And, you know, I mean, it's this idea of a nation at war. To get into war and sustain its public in support of its war, it needs to do two things. It needs to moralize and it needs to scaremonger, right? I mean, so in that you have both. You have, look how terrible this is. Look at how these people are suffering. We would never do this to anybody, right? And they say it with a straight face. We would never treat civilians this way. You know, people are being kept from their homes, et cetera, et cetera. You're doing the moralizing. And of course, the scaremongering is just tied right to that, right? In the sense that these barbarians on the other side of the border, these non-humans, right, whatever you have, they want to describe them, look at what they're doing. They're throwing rockets at us. They're committing, and of course, that ties into the whole Zionist Greater Israel narrative, which they stretch back 3,000 years. So, you know, when you look at it and kind of say, you know, you couldn't pay a Madison Avenue advertising firm to come up with a better marketing plan than what they've got right now.
Yeah. The other, you've mentioned there could be two reasons for this visit of the commander of CENTCOM to Israel. One of them is just leaving, and the other would be if you want to attack, do it as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And the question would be, right now with the situation of the Democratic Party, do they really have this in their mind that if something happens in that region, that would hugely affect their campaign, Kamala Harris' campaign?
So there you get, there's two things I want to get to on this, right? One, let's do that latter part point first, but when I lose my train of thought, which I'm going to do, as people who watch me know, please remind me, I want to talk about the military's insubordination to civilian authority in the U.S. and how that has continued to grow over the years. But this latter point, exactly that. This idea that the United States is going to go, Hezbollah, I think they could massage, particularly just jets coming off the carriers, a ton of cruise missiles, a ton of Tomahawks being fired at Hezbollah. The thing about it is it's not going to cause the economic markets will react to that, but it won't be like if the United States attacked Iran. I mean, you've heard Lindsey Graham and others saying how we should bomb Iranian oil facilities. That would be the most self-destructive, suicidal move. It might be good for Graham and the Republicans because it would totally crush the Democrats' hope in November. I mean, if you had that type of attack on Iran, where either you're going after the Iranian oil infrastructure and or the Iranians close the Strait of Hormuz for a while and you have to blast it back open. Either way, you know, here in the U.S., and I know our folks overseas, you know, y'all pay a lot more for your gas than we do, but your economies aren't built, your infrastructure isn't built on the internal combustion engine like we are here in the United States. That's a huge Achilles heel for us. So something like that happens, gas is going to go up. It's going to double overnight. We're paying $7, $8 a gallon here in the U.S. That would cause inflation to bump up over 5 or 6% at a minimum, let alone how the markets will react. Right? I mean, then the hysteria and then what the news media is going to say, you know, and so it would be a complete catastrophe for the Democratic Party, which is something that they have to be very wary of. And they've put themselves in this position. I mean, you got into this cage with this rabid madman, Netanyahu. You've been propping him up. You built the cage and you put yourself in it and threw the keys away. I mean, and so they've only got themselves to blame for being in the situation. And so the idea of an October surprise where Israel does something, where how can the U.S. not respond? I mean, you saw at the DNC, of course, the RNC, but this ironclad commitment to Israel. You know, certainly we've seen where Lindsey Graham has put forward a pre-authorization for war, basically saying, you know, if the president decides to go to war with Iran, he's got authorization to do so, right? I mean, so you've got all the political infrastructure there for such a conflict to be a catastrophe for the Democrats in November. And so that's one of several reasons. I also just don't think the Biden administration wants to go to war with Iran. I think while they are stupid across a lot of other lines with this particular issue, they actually, I don't believe, are interested in going to war with Iran. So, you know, so that's what I think would occur there. Maybe with Hezbollah, you can get away with it because the shock to the world's economy, shock to the American economy would be manageable. But with Iran, absolutely not. This gets to the other point, though, is can you trust the U.S. military? Can you trust the U.S. military not to position themselves into a way where they get what they want? And I'll say this for a number of reasons. I'll give several examples. During the Trump administration, the president of the United States, I don't care if you don't like Donald Trump or don't like Donald Trump. I've known Donald Trump my whole life. I hate that guy. You know, I grew up outside New York City. He is nothing but a grifter and a con man, a rapist, so forth, right? He's the president of the United States. The military has him as their commander in chief. Any type of insubordination should be a constitutional crisis. That's what occurs in Syria. When Donald Trump says, hey, we're getting out of Syria, and the U.S. military says, no, we're not doing it. And they lie to him. You know, Ambassador Jim Jeffries, who was the special representative for Syria for the American government, he bragged about it after Trump left office, how Trump said us to leave, told us to leave, and we didn't leave. We lied to him. We told him we were leaving, but we weren't leaving. Same thing occurs when Trump, when the United States government, it's not just Donald Trump, when the United States government makes the deal in Doha in February of 2020, with the Taliban, and they say we will be out of Afghanistan by May of 2021, the United States military doesn't do anything about it. They defy the order of the United States president to begin getting out of Afghanistan, to start preparing for it. Worse, they tell the Afghans, they give the Afghans, if there's a people in this world who couldn't have received any more false hope, it was the Afghans. But guess what? The American military found a way to do it in 2020 when they told the Afghans, you know what? We're not leaving. Trump gets out of office. When Biden comes in, we're going to stay. Don't worry about doing anything. Prepare for our departure. Don't worry about actually talking to the Taliban. We're staying. Of course, we didn't stay, and we all see what happened there, right? I mean, so you have this. This is two examples. When Biden comes in the office, he says, hey, no more drone strikes without the authorization of the White House. The U.S. military keeps doing drone strikes, particularly in Somalia, in defiance of that. White House does nothing, nothing to punish anyone for that insubordination. So we've seen over and over again this ability of the American military to do what it wants. And that's a really scary thing here. You have those within the American military who actually do believe destroying Iran. That's how they would see it. It would work out otherwise in real life. But they do believe that is the best thing for them. These are people who are still reading the works of Podhertz and Wormser and Wolfowitz from the 90s, the guys who were the project for New American Century, and believing it, right? And they believe it. These morons believe it. And there are 3- and 4-star generals. So I have no doubt that you could have this position where the American military is telling something to the Israelis, particularly their uniformed counterparts, that is in direct opposition to what the American civilian authorities are, because we've seen it. And we've seen this class within the American military, within American military officers. You know, you saw it particularly, say, if you go back and you look at who Donald Trump brought into his administration, H.R. McMaster, Jim Mattis, John Kelly. These were, even though they were contemporaries, and you could call McMaster, say, an acolyte of David Petraeus, they were very much opposed to that style of war fighting. Even though Jim Mattis co-authored the counterinsurgency manual for the U.S. military, he has very much this idea of being a modern day legionary. That's how they view themselves. And they view the world in a class of civilizations manner, where they need to be out on the outposts defending our civilization, our empire, from the barbarians. And when the barbarians have a base, when they're too strong, then it's our duty to ride forth and defeat them before they can attack our people. That's the way they see this. And so I'm really afraid that that's how key people in the U.S. military may be agreeing with Netanyahu and his folks who want this war, because it's not a monolith over there in Israel by any means, as everyone knows. So that's my concern, Nima. I mean, even though the White House does not want a war with Iran, because it would be a complete disaster for them electorally. How could it be otherwise? We had, for folks outside the U.S. in 2022, I don't know if you ever saw this, Nima, some guy, this was brilliant political advertising. When gas prices were very high in 2021, about twice as high as they are now, maybe not twice as high, 50% higher, 25% higher, still substantial. And again, Americans, we drive 30, 40 miles to work each way in our SUVs that get 20 miles to the gallon. I mean, and we drop our kids off on the way to school, on the way to work at school. I mean, so for people to drive 100 miles a day in the U.S. is normal. I mean, just to give people who are outside the U.S. an idea of why this is such a big important to us. But all throughout gas stations in 2022, you saw the sticker, you know, of on gas pumps of Joe Biden, you know, pointing his finger at the gas price. And then the caption said, "I did that." You know, like, I mean, it was brilliant. I mean, and so the Democrats are more, and there's a lot of actually good, there's been some work out there that shows that the reason why the Democrats actually do fairly well in 2022 in the midterms, that they don't get slaughtered like everyone was kind of predicting, like most people were predicting, and why they actually do pretty well is because Joe Biden releases the Strategic Oil Reserve of the United States, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and that keeps that actually brings down gas prices in the months before the election. So far as I know, we've restocked that reserve. So the idea that the White House wants this war is they don't. But the problem is there are people who do. And we all should be really scared by that because of who they are. It's just not Netanyahu, but very serious key people in the United States as well.
Yeah. The other thing, Matt, last week we had this new nuclear strategy of the Biden administration, and everybody was talking about this new strategy. They call it strategy of preemption, and just before they're attacking, we have to attack it the same way that Israel was attacking Hezbollah before attack. And why do we need, Matt, in your opinion, this type of, and first of all, what's your take on this strategy? How did you find it?
Oh, it's in line with the thinking and the madness of empire. It's in line with a militarized foreign policy that is devoted to greed and megalomania. I mean, two sides of the same coin. You can argue which is more important all day long. It doesn't matter. They're both present and they both reinforce each other. It's the idea that the United States is stuck in the fantasy of being perpetually in 1945, that those were our glory days. You know, it's like the United States is like your friend who doesn't shut up about his high school baseball team. You know, I mean, like they're still stuck 80 years ago. I think that all informs this idea of being able to fight. And this is what supposedly this new nuclear strategy entails, being able to fight three nuclear powers, essentially Russia, China, and North Korea, consecutively or concurrently, which is just absolutely insane. But it's bolstered by the desire to build out our weapon systems, right? To buy more, to spend more. Barack Obama's modernization program, which he begins in his second term in office, it was estimated at $1.7 trillion over 30 years. It's now looking at well more over $2 trillion. You just had an op-ed in the New York Times this past weekend by Mike Turner, who is the Republican in charge of the House Intelligence Committee, who said, honest to God, people, you should go look at this, because this is just how irresponsible, insane. And this man is the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Our new nuclear missiles, our ICBMs that are going to replace the Minuteman threes, the Sentinel, they are 81% over their cost projection. And Turner just basically says, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter how much they cost. We need to get these things, right? I mean, you might as well also say, it doesn't matter if they work either. Who cares if they work? We just need to keep pumping this money into my campaign benefactors And, you know, to the boards where eventually when I leave this position, I'm going to go to and get $400,000 a year to show up at a meeting twice a year. You know what I mean? Like that type of thing. The graft here, the corruption, the racket. I mean, President Eisenhower, God bless him. But when, you know, he didn't have a tenth of this when he warned us of the military industrial complex, he warned us about this. This is he was just talking about the tip of the iceberg here. I don't think Ike could realize what this was really, truly going to become in the sense of the entire capture of the entire American political media industrial system. He warns of it, but. You know, anyway, so, you know, the reason for it is just for that, because we have people who believe that we need to perpetually be in 1945, people who believe that, you know, it's like the philosopher and the presidential candidate Cornel West says, the United States is at the intersection of might makes right and greed is good. I mean, so that, I think that summarizes it. But this idea that you could fight three nuclear wars and there be anything left, you know, it gets to this idea of what C. Wright Mills called the crackpot realists. And that's what these people are. These people, and if you and I were to have this conversation in Washington, D.C., and they would, you know, hear it, we would be criticized as not serious, Nima. We are the not serious ones. The reason why we're not on CNN or being interviewed in Washington Post, because you and I are not serious. And maybe in a sense, yeah, because we don't indulge in the racket. We don't take part in the graft. We're not crackpot realists believing in our own fantasies. We're not fabulous, you know, in the sense of what the world looks like. So, I mean, you have... this very dangerous situation where we believe we can do this. And some of this is informed, you know, the scary things are it's this modernization effort has been reflected or has caused other nations to modernize and build up their fleets as well. There's a, you know, and this modernization effort comes with the United States unilaterally leaving three international agreements pertaining to nuclear weapons, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. George Bush left that unilaterally in 2001. Donald Trump left the Open Skies Treaty and then left the Intermittent Nuclear Forces Treaty. The only treaty of any of stuff that we have is the New START Agreement, which is due to expire in January 2026. And when that expires, everything's open. No more caps on anything. And so what you're seeing in Washington is a position in getting ready to make the arms race of the past seem quaint. The United States Congress has already passed law. So under New START, we're only allowed to have so many B-52s that can drop nuclear bombs or fire nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. The United States Congress has already passed into law that as soon as New START expires, the other B-52s or to be converted to be able to utilize nuclear weapons. I mean, that's already on the books. You know, you have to also too look at the technologies involved here. One of the reasons why I think that they feel they can fight and win three wars is because nuclear wars is because one, a lot of them adhere to this idea of escalate to de-escalate. And we have these smaller weapons, nuclear weapons that have lower yields. You know, on our cruise missiles, I think the lowest yield is 5 kilotons, which is 1/3 the yield of Hiroshima. The bombs that we can drop, the B-61s, they could be dialed back all the way to, I think it's 0.3 kilotons, which someone please do the math for me. But again, Hiroshima is 15 kilotons. These can be dialed back to 0.3 kilotons. This is what makes them usable. And if you adhere to this escalate to de-escalate strategy, particularly we've talked about this, and we saw then Sergey Lavrov essentially say last week, this idea of the Americans having a buffer in Europe and that nuclear war would first start in Europe and then only then expand to the United States is not the case. We will attack the United States as soon as we attack anyone else. So this idea of the American buffer is gone. But the idea with this is that we'd be able to engage in a limited nuclear war using these low-yield nuclear weapons, and it would escalate to de-escalate. So we get to the point where we drop a few, and then the other side would say, well, hang on, let's start talking. This is getting too crazy for us, right? You know, it's madness. It's madness. And then the other thing is the technologies involved here It used to be that our submarine launched ballistic missiles were not accurate enough to take out Russian nuclear missile silos or to take out their command and control systems. They just weren't accurate enough. And with nuclear weapons, accuracy is more important than yield. So if you have a smaller nuclear weapon with, say, 100 kiloton yield, but it's accurate, that's a much, much, much better weapon than, say, a weapon that has a 500 kiloton yield or even a 1 megaton yield, right? So what you have is you now have the ability, because they put on our submarines, what's called a superfuse, that makes a Trident II missile as accurate as our Minuteman III ICBMs. And so that now makes our nuclear subs first strike weapons. And so in the past, you had this balance because the other side couldn't launch a preemptive strike except coming out of their missile silos, right? And that, you've got 30 minutes notice, roughly. Plus also, too, the Russians, the way their early warning systems are set up, they can see our silos, but they really can't see our subs in the Indian Ocean or in the North Pacific or wherever they would launch from. So, you know, now you have this ability for our nuclear subs to launch a first strike accurate enough to not just take out the missile silos, but to take out their command and control centers. And guess what? It will be coming from locations where the Russians really can't see that well, and it won't take them 30 minutes to reach their target. It takes 15 minutes to reach their target. This has essentially freaked out the Russians. It's freaked out the Chinese. Understandably, when people hear about how the Chinese are expanding their nuclear fleet, how they're building out, you know, 20 years ago, they had 200 nuclear missiles and they were 200 nuclear warheads, and they're okay with that. Now they're at 500. They're supposed to go up to 1,500. I've heard from some people who know about this stuff pretty well. Now they're going past 2,000 towards 3,000 because, you know, with our superiority, plus as well as we're going to build out once New START is over, they have to. I mean, so the madness here, the madness of it all, is it the worst horrors that we lived through in the Cold War of having this sword of Damocles over your head, we're walking right back into that.
Yeah. And one of the reasons for this type of policy would be this endless conflict in Ukraine, Taiwan, in the Middle East. And it seems to me that the United States is so... it's unbelievable in creating people like Netanyahu. Right now, it seems that Zelensky is the new Netanyahu in Ukraine, and his friends in unbelievable. You see that they're coming, they're asking for money for weapons, and nobody seems to care that there has to be some sort of limits for what you're asking. And at the end of the day, Matt, it seems that the guy who is with Zelensky, the people behind who are running the administration, and these ultra-nationalists in Ukraine, these are the people in charge in Ukraine. And I don't know how much the United States has any sort of leverage in there.
Certainly this idea that Ukraine is a Frankenstein's monster, just as Israel is. And that we gave them the keys to control us, Israel, in the sense of our political system. Hey, it's legalized bribery. So you guys put together a good, strong lobby. Guess what? You're in charge. You know, the Ukrainians don't have that. But the Ukrainians also are fortunate in that the United States political system is not nearly as touched by public opinion as, say, the Europeans are. I mean, so we saw... over the weekend, whenever it was this morning, Olaf Scholz saying, yes, negotiations to end the war in Ukraine will have to occur at a faster pace than was expected. You know, that's got everything to do with the AFD and BSW doing well in elections last week, right? And with the Brandenburg elections coming up in this week or next week or whenever it is, the next election, state elections there, got everything to do with that. Shows you what pressure does, what pressure is. I mean, look what's happening in France right now. Look how, like, Macron is pointing, just completely upending their democracy. To keep the right in power because they're so afraid to give in to the left. But the whole thing about it is that there's such an upswell against this war in France, like in so many other places. It doesn't really matter who he appoints. You know, the same thing too in London, in the UK. Public opinion against the Labour Party is, you know, I think Keir Starmer is like the, or maybe I might be confusing him with Olaf Scholz. One of those two is like the least popular leader in 40 years or something like that. But at this point, they're both actually, I think, less popular than Joe Biden is. Right. I mean, so it's got so much to do about the Ukraine war, you know, I mean, and the fact that their citizens are hurting, you know, that their leaders went along with the sabotage, the economic warfare, destroying the Nord Stream pipeline, putting a hurt on their families, on their businesses for years now. I mean, one of the things that's got people really upset with labor in the UK is the fact that labor wants to cut back on the heating subsidies it provides the pensioners. I mean, literally turning off heat for old people. That's what the Labour Party is about these days. And you know, I mean, and you have to remember that, go back a year or two, and the saying, you know, we hear from our British friends was, well, everyone, people are talking about this Ukraine war, and the line that goes along with it is heat or eat, you know, because inflation was so bad. Energy prices were so bad. The war was disrupting the food commodities markets and causing food prices to go up. I mean, like, so the effect that it's having on Europe, and so the desperation that we're going to see from the Ukrainians is only going to increase. In the last week, they had that big reshuffling, which was just, I think, a political stunt, just like the Kursk invasion was. Essentially, look what we can do. I mean, that's nothing more than rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. But I think it's showing to the Americans that we will do our part. We will give you the theatrics, we will give you the newsreel, we will give you the talking points that you need to keep this war going. I mean, the thing about it, I look at it too, as well as why is this war going. When Zelensky comes at the end of the month, I would be shocked if he doesn't spend at least as much time with American financial leaders, you know, like the head of BlackRock, say, as he does with the American political leaders. Because remember, who are the ones who are supposed to reap the benefits of Ukrainian reconstruction? It's the American banks. BlackRock has already said it's going to put, you know, tens and tens of billions of dollars, $1 trillion, some estimates, how much it's going to be to build Ukraine. I mean, this is a cash cow. I mean, the bleeding out, dying carcass of Ukraine, these Wall Street vultures are salivating over. And if the Ukrainian government collapses and falls, they don't get their money. You know, let alone all these weapons contracts that are laid out. You know, I mean, tens and tens of billions of dollars laid out by the American government to pay for weapons that won't be delivered for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You're telling me that Boeing and Raytheon and Lockheed and General Dynamics are going to sit by and watch that not happen? So they're going to do everything they can to keep this government up. You know, I mean, so what that all means is that, do they go all in this idea of being foolish and thinking that nothing as bad is going to happen? Might makes right. We're the strongest nation in the world. We can fight and win 3 nuclear wars at one time. No one can hold the United States of America back. You know, this insanity. Or do the fiscal, the financial people start saying, you know what, it's time to start cutting your losses, because if you collapse, we get nothing. You know, I mean, so it reminds me of the arguments that are made for why the United States entered the First World War. And a lot of it, not all of it, there's plenty of reasons why, but some of it was the fact that the United States bankers were saying, you know what, if France and England get defeated, we're not getting our money back. We've loaned those guys a lot of money. You know, we want our money back. So you better send Wilson, you better send the army over there and win this thing. You know what I mean? So is that going to be the other message that comes out of it? Not so much, hey, cut your losses, but these financial leaders who don't know anything about the war other than what they're reading in the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or watching on CNN, God help them. Meanwhile, when they get briefed on it, they get briefed by guys like Ben Hodges or David Petraeus, right? So their whole understanding, their whole view on this. I mean, I'm saying this from experience, because I just briefed business leaders in London back in May, CEOs, presidents, managing directors, and many of them believed wholeheartedly in the narrative that comes out of Western media about this war. They thought it really was just, if we had just gotten the Ukrainians more money, if we had just given them F-16s earlier, then this thing would be wrapping up right now, right? I mean, so there's, we may be in the end phases of this, or, you know, I mean, my opinion with Ukraine is that if they drop their conscription age to 18, because remember, they don't conscript below 25. So if they start bringing the 18 to 25-year-olds, yeah, a lot of people are going to run away, of course. Good for them. I don't blame them. But they can fill out their ranks then. And if they can keep this money coming in, even though the economy is about to collapse, all three credit rating agencies have downgraded them to pre-default levels. You know, the IMF is unhappy with them. But I could see us where, yes, the Russians have advanced farther westward. They've reached more parts of the river. So, you know, but a year from now, still being talking about this because they're happy. They're happy, these people, whether they're in London, they're in Washington, D.C., they're the bankers in New York, they're in Brussels or they're Kiev. They're happy to just throw young men into the furnace to keep this thing alive, to make sure either they get their money back or they get the future earnings, which they feel they're entitled to, whether it be through large weapons contracts or the ability to rebuild Ukraine. And if anyone, you know, like me, who was involved in post-war reconstruction knows, there's no greater racket than that.
Matt, do you think that China, Xi Jinping, just today was talking about the conflict in Ukraine? He was talking about negotiations. Yeah. And right now, do you feel that the United States is going to be, is considering any sort of negotiations, or they're just totally in line with what's going on with Zelensky and his administration? Because we don't see anything coming out of the European Union. It doesn't seem that they do really have a solid opinion on their part.
Yeah, there's a bit of a dead-ender type of, right? I mean, that's certainly the EU and NATO, whether it's von der Leyen or Stoltenberg, and Stoltenberg's about to get replaced by, what's his name from Holland, who's even worse than Stoltenberg is. Their prime minister, who was there for like 15 years, I'm blanking on his name. Wait, he's terrible. So, but you know, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, I don't, with the Americans, you just had, you know, Zelensky's chief of staff, Yermak, here last week, as the papers in the U.S. reported, it was to prep and prepare as if he's like some kind of advanced party, you know, making sure the hotel rooms are going to be okay for Zelensky or something like that. But the back and forth, the trade-offs that must have gone on between, say, him and Sullivan, you know, is that why they went back and fired all these guys, Kaleba and others? You know, Zelensky, remember too, Zelensky, a couple of weeks ago, he said, I've got a 4-point plan that I'm going to give to President Biden and Vice President Harris, and it's going to win the war. Kursk is one part of it. And he talks about the diplomatic stuff. I mean, was that firing the foreign minister and bringing someone else in? You know, I mean, was that, you know, the economic thing? Is that just going to be, we're going to ask for more money from you? You know what I mean? So, but the idea that these people are desperate, what happens to them? Where do they go? I'm sure Zelensky will be okay. He'll be, you know, hanging out in the same condo as Netanyahu's son down in Miami or something like that. But, I mean, you know, what the Americans, the American mindset here too, the White House mindset and the Harris campaign mindset, you have to remember a year ago, the Biden campaign launched its first political ad for this election cycle. And it was as Joe Biden as wartime commander in chief. That was the first political ad of the Biden reelection campaign, a minute long of Joe Biden going to Kyiv and, you know, first American president to visit a foreign ally in a wartime, blah, 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 blah. You know, and that's really what they felt was good, solid ground. That's what they launched their campaign on. Because even though if you look at the numbers for the Americans, you know, a majority of Americans don't want to continue aid, particularly when they're told how much aid's already been given. I just saw a poll literally today, I think it was, maybe it was yesterday. But when Americans are asked about providing aid without knowing how much we've already given, it's roughly 50-50 of Americans who say, but when you tell Americans, you know, we've given Ukraine already $170 billion, that number jumps to 65% or so say, hey, no more aid to Ukraine. But that's not the Democratic Party base. And that's not Wall Street. And that's not the weapons companies, right? And that's not the foreign policy elite, the ideologues, the American exceptionalists, right? Who understand their imperative to not just maintain the American empire, but to grow it, right? I mean, so, which is a bit different than the Trump folks I was talking about earlier. So I think that's what's cycling in the white. I mean, and the other thing too, is that if we don't birth this, if this thing falls apart before November 5th, we could lose our jobs, right? So we just got to get it through. The good thing for the White House, bad thing for the world, the good thing for the White House is that the entire Democratic Party in the Congress is in lockstep with them. When the United States Congress voted last April on whether to send $61 billion more to Ukraine, I mean, most of that stays in the U.S. and goes to weapons companies, of course. But every member of the Democratic Party in the U.S. House, and I'm pretty certain everyone in the Senate as well, voted in favor of that. For the Republican side, there are a handful of senators who voted against it, Republican senators, and there are roughly, if I remember right, about 100 Republican members of the House who voted against it. So just, I mean, you've got an overwhelming majority, a supermajority in the Senate that is in favor of continuing this war in Ukraine. And you have close to 350 members of the House that are in favor of continuing this war. So they've got the Republicans on their side on this, no matter what Donald Trump says, and who knows what Donald Trump would do. And so I think the way that Harris has been performing in the polls has rekindled the flame in Kyiv that maybe there is hope, you know, maybe because I think they really were in June and July. Oh, my God, Trump's going to come and he's going to end this war. And then, you know, we better have our Gulfstream jets fueled and ready to go, take us to, you know, wherever they would go, Greece, Miami, et cetera. So, I mean, we'll see how this plays out in the next few weeks. But I think this idea that the priority is to get this through November 5th. And then after that, you know, they'll get another spending. If Harris wins, there'll be another spending. Even if Harris doesn't win, they'll still push a spending bill. The United States government there's a risk of a shutdown. Folks don't know, for the United States government, they may or may not do anything about that. Who knows? At best, you'll probably get what's called a continuing resolution, kick the budget down the road. In December, they're supposed to have the budget for FY25 completed. I think technically they're supposed to have the budget for FY25 completed now before it's FY25. But hey, it's the American Congress. I would say that I bet dollars to donuts that in December, we don't have a budget in the United States to support our own people, but there is a budget to support Ukraine going forward. So we will see. We'll see. I mean, certainly there are those who don't want to see this war go away, and they'll go to great lengths, including the risk of the Ukrainians to do foolish things. I mean, it's not just one nuclear power plant that they've sent drones to attack. They've done it to two. I mean, this is what we're dealing with here.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us today. Great pleasure as always.
Hey, thank you, Nima.